Welcome to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Joanne Cheng, here in the studio with my co-host, Allison Cole.
Hello.
In the control room is our technician, John Pranger. Today, we'll be speaking with Chef Merida from Sunday Vegan Secret Suppers. I will also be speaking with Nathan Winograd, author of the book, Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution. Winograd pioneered the No-Kill Revolution by turning the San Francisco SPCA, as well as the Tompkins County SPCA into no-kill shelters. I'm very excited for this interview today. But first, I'm going to turn the mic over to Allison for her review of one of Vancouver's newest vegan restaurant, Organic Lives.
Yes, I had the pleasure of attending the Earth Save Dine Out last Friday at the new and all-raw restaurant in Vancouver called Organic Lives. This was my second time there, the first just being a few weeks before, and after having a few delicious dishes in my first time around, I was excited to return last week for the Earth Save event, as I knew we would be sampling a vast variety of many other foods on the menu. Now, you may have noticed that I said this is a raw restaurant, and if I have caught you... And if I have caught you aback at this term, I will explain for those who are not familiar with the raw cuisine. The cuisine of vegan raw food is some of the healthiest and freshest sustenance on the planet and certainly makes a strong case for eating whole foods in their natural uncooked state, thus preserving the enzymes and nutrients in the foods that are normally killed off when they are cooked. The definition of raw food is food that has not been cooked over a temperature of 110 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the temperature at which those enzymes and nutrients are destroyed. Raw food can be as simple as eating an apple, an avocado, a handful of nuts, or a whole head of Swiss chard, as I've seen some people do.
Wow.
One can delve into the art of raw cuisine, uncooking, as I call it, which involves a formidable amount of grinding, shredding, soaking, and dehydrating of foods to manipulate them into elaborate forms of edible and often beautiful-looking nourishment. And Organic Lives is a restaurant, I must say, that offers such elaborate forms of edible and beautiful-looking nourishment. In fact, the whole experience the group of 38 of us had at this event was a bounty for the eyes as we ogled the delectable spread of vegan food porn proffered to us for our hedonistic consumption. What I'm saying is, it really was a lovely presentation. To start, we nibbled on some appetizers of sprouted teriyaki almonds alongside sesame onion gaufrettes, which were really tasty dehydrated crackers. I would have gladly filled up on these, but I didn't want to ruin my appetite for what was still to come. The main course was a plate for each person of the following items: Caesar salad with a yummy, creamy pine nut dressing, a slice of pizza loaded with minced vegetables and squirts of pesto that was bursting with flavor, vegetable sushi rolls, a slice of zucchini noodle layered lasagna, and a piece of lavender bread with vegan cream cheese. Every single item on this platter, I have to say, was a work of art on its own. You might wonder how a person could eat raw all the time, as some people choose to do. If the types of food available are as diverse with textures, vegetables, and flavors as this dinner was, then that answers the question how. I know I like a fury of flavors and variety in my meals, and sampling these fresh and wholesome foods without cruelty to animals was just an invigorating experience to be appreciated and savored. But I have not even gotten to the dessert yet, which, in my opinion, was the best part of the meal. The first time I went to Organic Lives, I had a piece of their strawberry shortcake, which was really delicious. This time, we sampled four different desserts: a chocolate macaroon, tiramisu, chocolate cashew cheesecake, and the ridiculous ganache, as it's called on the menu. We oohed and aahed at every bite of every morsel of chocolatey goodness presented to us on our plates, and some, I think, even licked their plates. It was that good. At the end of the meal, the owner of the restaurant, Preet, came to speak to our group about Organic Lives, which uses food ingredients that are not only organic, but always produced using fair trade and sustainable farming practices. He said that they will be opening a culinary school at their location soon, as well as will be offering breakfast and lunch starting next month. To sum up what they are all about, I will quote from their mission statement: Organic Lives provides the education, support, and resources to sustain a plant-based lifestyle. Whether you are interested in making the transition for personal health and fitness, fighting climate change, reducing poverty, or protecting the species of this planet, our foundation of life will help you achieve your goals. And I say, what better way to help the animals than through eating wholesome and vibrant plant-based foods such as this? Organic Lives is located at 1829 Quebec Street in Vancouver and can be found online at www.organiclives.ca.
Thanks for that, Allison. I must say, I'm not a big fan of raw food, but I love everything at Organic Lives and their desserts. It doesn't even taste like it's not cooked. It just tastes like the real stuff.
Yeah, I think with a lot of desserts, you really don't need to cook the desserts. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of no-bake dessert recipes as it is.
So
for
it's
sure.
A great restaurant. Everybody should try it. Well, next on the line here, joining us is Chef Merida, the creator of Vegan Secret Supper in Vancouver. Hi, Merida. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. So why is this called Secret Supper? What is the secret?
I guess because it's not a real restaurant. I guess that would be why it's secret.
Okay. So it's hosted at your home?
Yes.
Okay. Great. So I know your secret suppers are not really all that secretive because I've seen it covered on CBC and the Vancouver Sun, Veg News Magazine, and tons of foodie blogs. So what do people have to do to get a table at your secret supper?
Really just have to email me and then we can chat it from there.
Okay, and how do they find out about your email address?
I have a little website.
Okay.
So they can get it through there.
Okay, excellent.
And, yeah.
Now, what motivated you to start the Vegan Secret Supper?
I actually went to a supper in Halifax with a friend of mine who does it, and it was a three-course vegan supper, and it was really inspiring to see that, and I should totally do that. Mm-hmm. And I've been working on a cookbook for a long time, and it'd be perfect. I could just, test out the recipes and...
So are you a chef? Were you a chef before this?
No.
did you cook at home?
Yeah, I'm curious to know what your background is in cooking because, man, all of your menus look amazing. I have yet to try it yet, but I am always going, oh, my goodness, that looks so delectable. It looks so sophisticated. Mm-hmm. What process did it take for you to get to where you are now in cooking all of these delicious meals?
Well, I've been vegan for 10 years. And I guess that's when I started learning how to cook myself when I was 16. So I don't know. I just kept cooking. And my brother is a chef. And, if I sit down and talk to him for, 5 minutes, he'll explode my mind with food knowledge. And I don't know. I just, if you just do it enough, you just get there,
Wow. So I guess you're just a natural talent.
Maybe, I don't know.
So I know that the Secret Supper has intrigued a lot of foodies who normally wouldn't even set foot in a vegan restaurant. So why do you think that they all want in on this vegan Secret Supper?
I think it's a lot of the experience of it, and I also don't try to make it, I don't want to make it scary for someone who is really, there are a lot of skeptical people when it comes to vegan food, and I just want people to come in and eat good food, regardless of what they think, open their mind to be like, oh, vegan food doesn't have to be, what they thought it was.
Right, right.
And it's not, I don't really cook with tofu and things like that to make it also a little more accessible.
Okay, so you cook with more, fresh ingredients that are familiar with to most meat eaters?
Well, not really. I guess I just don't. I don't use much soy anymore, just because I. Mm-hmm. When you're vegan and you realize one day that you've eaten soy at every meal, it doesn't feel that great.
It is possible to be vegan without soy, despite what some people might think.
Yeah, I've been soy free for a month and a half now, so it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's great.
So, how many people do you normally serve on a Sunday night?
Anywhere from 20 to 30.
20 to 30. Mm-hmm. And does it pack up your place?
Yeah, I do two sittings.
Okay. So are all these dishes original recipes that you've created?
Yes.
Wow.
How do you think of these?
Yeah.
For example, we've got this week cauliflower pea curry with baked mustard, sweet potato on parsley quinoa with coconut sour cream and papadum. How does someone even think of creating that mix of flavors, and how do you do that?
I don't know. I think it's, you know, I think my brain is, like, probably on it all the time. I'm always thinking about it, and also, you know, looking at what's in season or what's in your backyard or what's, I don't know. I don't even know.
So these combinations just come to you because you're just always thinking about them. You just went one day, cauliflower would go really good with baked mustard sweet potato. And, you know, there you go. Voila, you've got a dish.
Kind of like Picasso, right? You can't say, how do you know how to paint something so nice?
Well, I think you are an artist of sorts.
Yeah,
an
definitely.
Artist of food for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and... I guess so. Yeah.
So, what kind of feedback are you getting? I'm curious. Like people, I'm guessing there's, you know, the regular vegans, but as Joanne mentioned, a lot of like those foodies who are not necessarily vegan, and just people from all over who've heard about you from the Vancouver Sun or CBC. What has the range of response been like for your meals?
It's been really great, actually, and actually most. I would say about half and half are vegetarian and half are not.
That's like, great.
You know, maybe one vegetarian will bring, you know, their friends or their family and, oh, no, I'm a meat eater, you know, and they all come out and, you know, I think they're pleasantly surprised, especially the meat eaters, because, you know, they're expecting, they have expectations of, you know, what they think vegan is. And for the vegans, you know, there isn't, I mean, there's getting to be more in the city, but, you know, it's definitely an option that, is there that you can't find everywhere.
I know a guy who went to your secret supper earlier this year, and he told me that it was the best meal he had ever eaten by far anywhere, vegan or non-vegan.
Wow.
I don't know if he told you that, but wow, that's, I just thought you'd like to know that.
Wow.
And I do mention that, you know, I promote your suppers on our show pretty much every week, and I have mentioned that before just so people can get out. I yet have not made it out, but it's definitely on my list.
Mm-hmm.
I know Joanne has gone out a couple times.
Yeah, I've been there twice, both with meat eaters, and they just cannot stop raving about the food. So I wanted to know if you have any future plans to share your recipes. You mentioned something about a cookbook.
Yeah,
I've been working on a cookbook, and I mean, unfortunately, my computer crashed, and I lost everything.
Oh, no.
So
Back up.
I know. I backed it up, and I backed it up wrong, because I'm not good at it. But anyways, I am working on a cookbook eventually, and so hopefully I can, you know...
Well, everything is in your brain, right? You're inspired, so you can come up with multiple cookbooks if you have to.
Yeah.
So what's the next secret supper menu?
Well, I guess it's the one that you mentioned.
Okay.
That's this Sunday, and it's a three-course roast fennel and portobello soup with rosemary, sage oil, and chive flowers.
Wow. That sounds fancy.
What you mentioned, the cauliflower pea curry with the roasted mustard yams on a coriander parsley quinoa pilaf with coconut sour cream and papadum.
Mm.
And dessert is a dark chocolate cake with local organic hazelnut, caramel, and lavender white chocolate ice cream.
That sounds delicious. And how much is the three-course meal for?
It's 20.
Oh, my goodness.
That sounds like a good, really great deal.
Totally. That's great. So, yeah, we hope lots of people will show up after listening to Animal Voices.
What's your website, Marita?
It's vegansecretsupper.com.
Pretty easy to remember. And I believe your email address is also pretty easy, vegansecretsupper@gmail.com, if people just want to shoot you an email to make a reservation. And you always have your upcoming menus on your website, right?
A week before, I'll post it.
And photos. Just see the photos, and then you'll get so excited you want to go. So thank you so much for chatting with us, Marita.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
So that's Chef Marita, creator of Sunday Vegan Secret Supper. To find out more, you can visit the website vegansecretsupper.com. Okay. You are listening to Co-op Radio on Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Now it's time for the Animal Voices news. There are two vegans competing for the Miss USA pageant this year.
Yeah, I saw that.
Miss New York USA Davina Reeves went vegan after suffering from health issues, skin flare-ups, and overall lethargy. While other Miss USA contestants have to follow strict diets. Davina says she enjoys the freedom of her plant-based lifestyle. I don't have to really watch what I eat, says Davina. I have freedom. Pretty much any mixture of what you put in is good for you. Mackenzie Green, Miss District of Columbia, USA, wrote in the bio of her Twitter page, I'm Miss DC USA 2010, a vegan, an aspiring sports reporter, and a lot more. Green has been taking to Twitter to share her diet preference, making tweets that are anti-cheese, anti-egg, and making suggestions for vegetable tempura. The pageant will be broadcasted live Sunday, May 16th.
It sounds like great news. Imagine if a vegan became the, what is it, Miss USA?
Miss USA. Yeah, that would be awesome. She can influence a lot of kids.
Yeah, really.
So earlier this week, the Ontario SPCA announced that it was going to euthanize all of the 350 rabbits, cats, dogs in its shelter after a ringworm outbreak. Kate McDonald, OSPCA's chief executive officer, says the animals are being euthanized to avert a public health issue. But York Region's infectious disease manager, Ken Brown, says the public is not at risk. Ringworm is a fungus that infects the skin and is easily treatable condition. In most cases, ringworm is self-limiting, meaning that it will self-cure over time. The only logical reason the OSPCA recommended a mass euthanasia is to save money. Controversy quickly brewed over this announcement. A Facebook group was set up, which grew to 7,500 members overnight, and a protest was scheduled to take place outside of the OSPCA the next day. Upon receiving the news, pet product retailer Pet Value immediately revoked its sponsorship of the organization. Amidst the controversy, OSPCA scaled back their original plan. Currently, of the 350 animals in question, 99 have been euthanized, 96 are in foster care, 15 were stolen from the facility, and 91 cats and 23 dogs will be tagged for further testing. So that's it for our Animal Voices news this week.
And now we have our upcoming events. Saturday, May the 15th at 6:30 p.m., that's tomorrow, Earth Save Canada's monthly vegan potluck will be held, which is open to all. This is being held in an Earth Save member's home in Kitsilano, Vancouver. I happen to know the person whose home it will be at, Chris, and she's got a really nice home. So these events are really great opportunities to taste a really large range of vegan food, and they're open to everyone. I've noticed on the list of people that have RSVP'd, there's a lot of new faces, so don't be scared to come.
There's meat eaters too, right? Omnivores and everybody.
Yeah, even the host is an omnivore. Earth Save is open for everyone. It's about transitioning to a plant-based diet, and it's about just partaking and learning more about plant-based foods.
Right.
So this is a social gathering that Earth Save Canada puts on once a month in people's homes, and as of yesterday, there were already 37 people signed up for this event, with room for some more. So that means that there will be over 30 delicious plant-based dishes for you to eat. Please bring a dish to share with no animal products in it so that everyone from omnivore to vegan can partake. There will also be a barbecue to grill veggies if you like. The exact address will be emailed out to those who RSVP, yes. And to do so, go to meetup.com and look up Vancouver Meatless Meetup. On Sunday, May the 16th, at 6 o'clock and 8 p.m., will be the three-course vegan secret supper, which we were just talking about, at a secret location in Vancouver. Secret suppers are home-prepared meals served in people's homes for a set fee and a secret location. And hopefully you've learned a little bit more about secret suppers from our interview we had about 5 minutes ago. On the menu for this week's secret supper, a fennel and portobello soup with sage rosemary olive oil, cauliflower pea curry with baked mustard, sweet potato on parsley, quinoa with coconut, sour cream, and papadum, and chocolate cake with chocolate hazelnut, caramel sauce, and white chocolate lavender ice cream. $20 for the meal to make your reservation. And for any questions, email vegansecretsupper@gmail.com. And finally, on Friday, May the 21st until Monday the 24th, from 1 to 4 p.m., there will be a Cloverdale Rodeo protest. The rodeo itself is at 6050A-176th Street in Surrey, BC. A group of individual activists will be protesting the animal cruelties at the Cloverdale Rodeo each afternoon for these 4 days. They will be providing car rides from the King George SkyTrain station at noon for those who need them. For more information, please contact Lachlan at 604-576-8000. 8708.
And I just want to mention that I really encourage everybody to go out there to support Lachlan. Lachlan is a guy in his 70s, and he's been out every single year with his placards just to speak out for the animals. And it would really, you know, lend him a lot of support and the animals a lot of support if he's not there by himself.
Thank you, Joanne. Yeah. If you have an animal or a vegetarian-related event coming up that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver.
Great. Thanks, Allison. You're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Our next guest is Nathan Winograd. Nathan is the author of Redemption, the Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution. Winograd pioneered the No-Kill Revolution by turning the San Francisco SPCA as well as the Tompkins County SPCA into no-kill shelters. Hi, Nathan. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
So in a nutshell, can you tell us what is the difference between a no-kill shelter and a regular run-of-the-mill SPCA or a pound?
Well, you know, ever since San Francisco achieved what everyone said was impossible, which was saving every healthy homeless dog or cat that entered any San Francisco shelter, there have been a number of SPCAs, humane societies, and even public pounds that have embraced the philosophy across the United States and now across the world and have even surpassed San Francisco. These are shelters that are saving not just all the healthy animals coming through their doors, but they're also saving all sick, injured, unweaned, traumatized who are savable, reducing, or I should say bringing the idea of the term euthanasia back to its dictionary definition, which is what it should be, you know, a relief from suffering for truly hopelessly ill or suffering animals, and not what it has become, which is essentially a euphemism for mass killing that is occurring in traditional shelters, not just across the U.S., but Canada and elsewhere.
Right. Now, to give our listeners an idea of the magnitude of this issue, can you tell us how many healthy animals are killed in shelters each year?
Well, I can tell you about the country that I know really well, which is the United States, but it's not too different in other countries in terms of a percentage of animals.
Right,
right now in the U.S., about 8 million dogs and cats are entering our shelters every year, and roughly half of those are put to death. So of the 4 million put to death, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 92, 93, 95% are savable, meaning that they are healthy or they're treatable.
Right.
And for them, they're being killed in the face of these readily available life-saving alternatives that communities across our country, communities in Australia, New Zealand, and increasingly communities in Canada are proving are viable alternatives to killing.
So what are some of the justifications given by shelters for killing so many healthy animals?
Well, the sad thing is that, you know, when we think of an SPCA or a humane society, and you sort of talked a little bit about the scandal brewing up there with the shelter that, you know, claimed it was going to, or announced it was going to put to death even healthy animals because some of them got ringworm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way we've always done it. We've been told for the last 100-plus years that you know, the best we can do for these homeless animals is to adopt a precious few and to kill the rest. And even in the face of these now very and increasingly stark comparisons, communities in the U.S. and communities in Canada that have proved that there is a kinder, more compassionate way to run animal shelters, you know, run them in ways that doesn't mean killing for healthy and treatable animals. These shelters, a lot of these shelters aren't employing the strategies that have eliminated the killing of healthy and treatable animals in communities across the country, because there has been no incentive to do so. They continue to blame the public for the killing. They continue to claim that there are too many animals and not enough homes.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to claim that no-kill is impossible, even though it's been achieved in a number of communities across the globe.
Right. So Okay, for a little bit of a personal question, my cat, I think, is one of the sweetest cats I know. The neighbor's kids and everyone who gets to know him just falls in love with him. So I would say he's an all-around charmer, a real people cat. However, when he's in an unfamiliar surrounding like the vet's office, he becomes so fierce that he has to be sedated before the vets can even get near him with heavy gloves on. Now, what would happen if I died in a car crash and my cat ended up at a regular shelter, and what would happen to him if he ended up at a no-kill shelter?
Well, the tragedy is if he ended up at a traditional shelter, they would use his fearfulness as an excuse to kill him. They would never give him a chance to calm down. They would never place him in a foster home to see
if... So they're just using any excuse.
Correct. I mean, even if your cat didn't act that way in an unfamiliar surrounding, even if he was perfectly sweet and healthy in the shelter that he might end up at, they would still likely kill him because, again, at least in the U.S., And in some communities, you know, as much as 60, 70, 80% of cats are being killed in shelters, and the vast majority of those are very sweet and friendly and good-natured and young. If he ended up at a no-kill shelter, that wasn't no-kill in name only, that was expressing its practices were the full expression of the no-kill ideal, which is that every life is precious. Mm-hmm. And he was acting fearful and scared, you know, traumatized because he's away from his surroundings and the only home he's ever known. They would place him, one, they would give him time to calm down, but two, they would place him into a foster home away from the fearful shelter environment to see if his true personality comes out. And what you describe for your cat is not terribly uncommon. And at least when I was running shelters, and we put a lot of these fearful animals into a private home where they can get one-on-one TLC, they truly blossomed.
Right. Wow, this is great. So, well, obviously aggressive cats are a little bit different than aggressive dogs in terms of the damage they're able to do. So how successful is rehabilitating aggressive dogs using the no-kill philosophy?
Well, the best performing shelters in the United States, I just got back from New Zealand, and there are communities there that are implementing the no-kill model. The best performing shelters there have managed to save about 97% of all dogs.
Wow.
And so that really leaves a very, very small number of dogs that sort of fall outside what we, at this point in history, consider savable in terms of aggression or medical. Now, keep in mind that 3, 4, 5%. Some of those are medical cases, and I guess the situation might be a dog that gets hit by a car and has multiple medical injuries and is truly suffering and can't be patched together. But the majority of that 3, 4, 5% are aggression in dogs. Mm-hmm. Now, I actually believe that when we achieve a no-kill nation in the U.S., when Canada achieves a no-kill nation, when no-kill becomes the norm, the next debate we're going to have is what to do about those 3% of dogs who are truly vicious with a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. I mean, they might be healthy, but they are an immediate danger to the public. Right now, those dogs are tragically killed. But at some point where, as no-kill becomes hegemonic and we continue to push the envelope towards more compassion, we're going to have debates on whether it's truly ethical to put those dogs to death, and particularly when the hospice care movement and the sanctuary movement dovetail with the no-kill movement, I think eventually our societies are going to go towards truly zero killing in shelters. But right now, the challenge in shelters is to save those that are medically and behaviorally savable, and we're talking about 95, 96, 97% of all the dogs.
Wow. Now, can you give us an example of an aggressive dog that was rehabilitated using the no-kill method?
I can tell you an example that I had in my shelter. This, we as the animal control shelter got a call about a dog chained in the backyard with no food, no water, no socialization. And it turned out when our officers got there that this dog, the gentleman in question, and, you know, I use that term loosely, got this really young puppy at 8 weeks old, chained him to an old logging chain in his backyard, and that's where the dog stayed for 8 years.
Oh, no.
By the time we got this dog, she was globally under-socialized, very fearful, and because food apparently had been scarce, every time you put food in front of her and if you tried to go near her while she was eating, she would snap, you know, thinking that you were trying to take away her groceries, which she hadn't had on a regular basis. We rather than do what most shelters would have done and put her to death, we actually worked with her for a while in the shelter, and because we were an open door shelter, meaning, you know, we turned no animal away in our county, space became a premium. We sent her into a foster home, someone that worked with her, and one of the ways they worked with her is by making her understand that in her new life, toys and treats and food was in abundance, and she literally had as much as she could eat all around her, toys and treats and food, bowls in every room in the house, and slowly desensitized her to the fact that when people approached her while she was eating, they were going to give her affection and not take away her food. We did end up turning her around. We did end up finding her a loving new home, and we did end up monitoring and providing ongoing support to the new home to see if any of the behaviors came back, and they didn't. And what was really exciting for me and for the staff was a couple years later, she came to our annual dog walk with her family, including this little boy who was just hanging all over her, and she was giving him affection and giving everyone licks and kisses. And, you know, that is the truest expression of what shelters can be and should be, and tragically too many aren't.
Right. So if she ended up at a regular shelter, she wouldn't even have gotten that chance. She would have just been killed.
Right. And, you know, the fiction that most shelters give is, well, you know, no-kill shelters close their doors and they limit their admissions. And the reality is that it's true at this time in history that many, if not most, no-kill shelters only take in a limited number of animals. But it's not true that it has to be that way. Mm-hmm. The shelter that I ran, we were the animal control shelter. So we were the open admission shelters. And, you know, there are open admission animal control shelters saving, you know, 8 out of 10 dogs and cats, 9 out of 10 dogs and cats, not just across the United States, not just in, you know, urban communities and rural communities, but they are now in Australia, they are now in New Zealand, and increasingly you have some good examples of very successful life-affirming shelters in Canada.
Does open admission mean that you take any cats and dogs that come in?
Yes, that's the difference. I mean, a private shelter, you know, doesn't have to take in every dog or cat or other animal, frankly, that is presented to them. They can close their doors and say, look, we're full, you know, we'll get back to you when we're open. And I actually think that's the ethical way to do it for private shelters, because they should not be in the business of killing animals. But the good news is that, you know, the goal in the United States and increasingly in Canada and all over the world is not just to create more no-kill shelters, although those are welcome, but to create no-kill communities, meaning every shelter in a given community is no-kill, even those shelters that run animal control programs, meaning they take in all animals that come to them from a particular community. And there are great examples of no-kill animal control open admission shelters across the globe now.
So you mentioned earlier, is San Francisco a no-kill city?
Well, San Francisco was the first city where there's two major shelters in San Francisco, the private SPCA and the public pound, the Department of Animal Control. And in a partnership between the two, no healthy dog or cat was killed throughout the 1990s while I was there, and even after I left, and frankly before I got there. It was really my boss, a man named Richard Avanzino, who caused the great changes in that city. What I did when I left, San Francisco, was take that model to an upstate New York community that went further. So San Francisco saved all healthy dogs and cats, which was the first step towards a no-kill community. Tompkins County, New York, became our country's first no-kill community when it saved not just the healthies, you know, not just what we affectionately call the cute and cuddlies, but also the old and uglies, you know, the ones that come in elderly, sick, injured, unweaned, traumatized. If they were savable, we patched them together and found them loving new homes.
Oh. So does the no-kill philosophy propose that no animal should be killed at all, even if they're too sick or aggressive to be rehabilitated?
Well, at this time in history, the short answer for that is no. I mean, what we're really trying to do in the face of shelters that kill even, you know, healthy and friendly young dogs and cats and other animals is to save about 93, 94, 95%. As I said, the most successful ones are pushing about 97%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the tragic reality is that there are always going to be some animals that are irremediably suffering, and there are always going to be some dogs that are truly vicious with a poor prognosis to be rehabilitated. But for 90-plus percent of the animals that don't meet those limited definitions, they can and should be saved at this time in history. But as I said earlier, I think at some point, as the movement to provide hospice care for animals the way we do for people, and the sanctuary movement that gives these dangerous dogs some place to go where they're not a threat to public safety and have good quality of life, I think ultimately, after we achieve the first stage of the no-kill revolution, we are going to push the envelope towards no animals being killed.
Now, it sounds like the no-kill approach is an extremely sensible and thoughtful way of dealing with shelter animals. However, you have some very surprisingly loud critics from the animal rights and animal welfare movements, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind addressing some of the criticisms. So one criticism I hear is that no-kill shelters become stagnant very quickly and you end up not being able to accept new animals, and that the animals in the shelters have a low quality of life because they're kept in cages for years without being able to move through the system. Can you address that issue for us?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think it's tragic that the groups that should be at the forefront of elevating the status of animals in society and advancing their rights are the ones that are demanding that animals be killed. And it is tragic because, you know, the arguments they make are intended to paint the alternative to killing as darker. You know, when I was running an open admission shelter, our average length of stay, meaning the average length of time an animal spent in our shelter before finding a new home, was only 8 days. Mm-hmm. And I never had a dog or cat celebrate an anniversary in my shelter. It is true that some of them were there for weeks, and it's true that a smaller percentage were there for months. But they, you know, in the case of dogs, they were walked 4 times a day.
Wow.
They were socialized by volunteers. They received plenty of love and attention. In the case of cats, they had to come out of their cages twice a day to romp around. And what we did was set up these baby gates that you might use for a human child to keep them confined in an area. And set up, you know, we had cat climbing trees and toys, and they could run around twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess the easy answer to that is, you know, what would you want if you were a dog or cat? You know, if you had to sit in a shelter, say, for 3 months or 4 months or even 5 months, and during that time you got played with, you got food and water, you got love and attention, you got walked 4 times a day, and ultimately you found a loving new home for the next 10 or 15 years of your life, isn't that always infinitely preferable to a certain death?
Right.
And that really is the calculus. And to have, you know, to have these animal rights groups that, look, I'm sympathetic to a lot of their programs. I've been an ethical vegan for 20 years, and I volunteered for a lot of these organizations before I found out, you know, that they were opposed to saving the lives of dogs and cats. If they want people to be thoughtful about what they eat and what they wear and the products that they use and whether they have been or have not been tested on animals, the bridge to that, the bridge to get them to be sympathetic and empathetic to suffering on farms and in laboratories and, you know, those animals used for entertainment is by those animals that they are very near and dear to their hearts, that are members of their families, which is dogs and cats. How do you get people to care about chickens if you're telling them that dogs and cats should be killed? It's burning the bridge that will get people to be sensitive to those larger animal rights issues.
Right. And, okay, so another criticism I've heard, I think you sort of addressed this earlier, is that a lot of no-kill shelters are limited admission shelters. So so the criticism is that while you may have 100 animals that you care for very well, you're turning away thousands of other animals who end up at other kill shelters. So essentially, no-kill shelter is just passing on the killing to someone else.
Well, again, it's the same type of argument that shelters are making that kill right now in groups that support killing to paint the alternative as darker. Really, if you take the flip side, what they're saying is that no-kill shelters are derelict because they refuse to kill animals. Mm. And if a shelter can only take in 100 animals without killing, then they should only take in 100 animals without killing. But the good news is that the no-kill revolution is not just, as I said earlier, about creating more no-kill shelters, mm-hmm. but creating no-kill communities. And there are open admission shelters. In other words, there are no-kill communities across the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's a couple now in New Zealand. There's two in Australia. And you have open admissions shelters and communities in Canada that are also saving in excess of 90% of the animals. I think one of the most exciting things we're seeing now is this sort of global race to see who will become the first no-kill nation. And I always thought the U.S. would cross the goal line first because we had a 15-year head start. Mm-hmm. But New Zealand is aggressively moving in that direction. They have two no-kill communities. Australia has two no-kill communities now, and there are communities and shelters. There's an SPCA, and forgive me if I butcher the name of it, but the Yarmouth SPCA up in Canada started out with saving only 16% of the dogs and cats in its facility. They're up to almost 80%.
Wow.
And they're very close to crossing the goal line. And that by implementing the programs and services like foster care that provide alternatives to killing.
So can you give us some stats comparing the adoption rates between no-kill and kill shelters?
Well, in the United States, right now, if you were a homeless cat and you entered your average shelter, you would have a 60% chance of being killed. If you entered a poorly performing shelter, you would have a 90% chance of being killed. Whereas if you entered a no-kill shelter, you would have a 93% chance of finding a loving new home. Mm-hmm. So the mirror opposite, I mean, really, really stark differences. And let me give you a global perspective. If every shelter in every community across the U.S. actually embraced the no-kill philosophy, then of the 4 million dogs and cats killed annually in the United States, 3.6 million instead would find loving new homes. So the differences between the two is very stark and very dramatic. And the good news is it's very doable.
Right. In your opinion, Nathan, are there enough homes for these 3.6 million people, or do we need to change the mindset of our society to get people to adopt more from these shelters?
Well, the answer is yes to both, but it's actually a very positive picture. So every year in the United States, about 21 million Americans are looking to bring a new dog or cat in their home. And, you know, it's a certain percentage. Yeah, a certain percentage of those are already committed to getting their animal from a shelter, and those are the ones adopting today. A certain percentage got their last animal from a commercial source like a breeder, and that's where they're going for the new one. But there are 17 million of those 21 million that have not decided where they're going to get an animal from, and surveys show that they have a sympathetic view of shelters. All we have to do is convince about 10 to 20% of those to adopt from a shelter, meaning that even if 80 to 90% of those 17 million got their animal from somewhere other than a shelter, we could still zero out the killing. So essentially, we have about 17 million people vying for just over 3 million animals. That is a very doable proposition.
Do you have a program set up to educate people about, you know, not buying pets, spay and neuter, that sort of thing?
Well, that's, you know, getting your animal from a shelter has always been a big part of trying to reduce the killing. And, of course, spaying and neutering is also central to that, because even though there are more people looking to bring animals than are being killed in shelters, we do want to reduce the number of unwanted animals entering those facilities, because mm-hmm. the less animals, the less killing, and the less they compete for space and those kinds of things. And particularly because a lot of shelters are performing very poorly, we don't trust them with the animals. We want as few as possible. But yes, I mean, one of the sad misconceptions among some of the public is that animals entering shelters are damaged goods, meaning they wouldn't be in a shelter if there wasn't something wrong with them, when the reality is that the average age of an animal entering a shelter is very young, lower than 2 years old. I mean, these are very young animals, and a lot of, and over 80% of them, 90% of them are healthy, meaning they have absolutely nothing wrong with them, and they happen to enter the shelter for reasons that had nothing to do with them. A family moves, a family gets divorced, a pet runs away and gets lost, and ends up at the shelter after the family stopped looking for them because they think they've been killed. I mean, so many unwanted litters. I mean, healthy, loving, friendly animals who just got a bad break. And so part of the process of increasing the market share, of convincing you know, some of that 17 million to adopt from a shelter, is educating the public that, that shelters are filled with very healthy, very friendly, very loving, and even purebred animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people say, well, I want to go to a breeder for purebred animals, but those animals end up at the shelter, so you get tons of purebreds in the shelter.
Right. There's a flip side to that, and that is, you know, a lot of inbreeding causes problems in some of these lines of purebred animals. And so your basic mutt tends to be better socialized and healthier than some of these animals that end up at pet stores because, you know, they're being fed by these abusive puppy mills that don't think about what's in the best interest of the dogs, for example. They just think about maximizing profits. And so the same types of abuse and neglect and unhealthiness that you see, for example, on a factory farm, you'll also see on in these puppy mills that feed the purebred pet store market, which you can actually think of as factory farms for dogs.
Mm-hmm. Now, for a more controversial question, I think we touched on this a little bit earlier. So on the polar opposite of your no-kill philosophy is PETA, who kills an average of close to 90% of the animals they take in. What is your opinion about what PETA is doing, and why do you think they're killing so many animals?
Well, to me, PETA is the ultimate betrayal in the animal rights philosophy, because they're, again, this is a group that's saying, you know, animals aren't ours to eat, animals aren't ours to wear or to experiment on or entertain. And as I said, you know, I started in this movement from the animal rights side, you know, and so I'm sympathetic to a lot of those arguments. In fact, I've got my a book that I have coming out next year is actually a vegan cookbook. PETA has betrayed the animal rights philosophy by arguing that while you should be kind to a pig, for example, you should kill dogs and cats in shelters. And the only reason they argue of that is because their founder and their leader, Ingrid Newkirk, started she started in this movement not on the animal rights side as I did, for example, but she started in a kill shelter, and not just any kill shelter. The Washington Humane Society has been a shelter that has historically had a very poor public image because of poor care of the animals and overkill, and she herself describes going to work early and killing these animals herself, and she's bringing that mindset of killing to an organization that should have a different mission. I'll tell you this, when Ingrid Newkirk resigns or is fired or dies, when she's no longer PETA, there is no doubt in my mind that PETA will embrace the no-kill philosophy and even be one of its foremost proponents. But the tragic thing is, until she's gone, we have to contend with an organization that violates its duty to animals, not just by preaching death, but by also killing, as you said, over 90% of the animals they claim to rescue. And they are actually seeking these animals out only to put them to death without even trying to find them homes. They don't put out a call for adopters among their millions of members. They don't do off-site adoptions. They don't use any of the $30 million they raise every year to try to save those animals. Instead, they're given a quick death behind closed doors. And too often, they'll tell people that they're going to try to find the animal a home, and those animals will be dead in the back of a van within minutes of departing.
And a lot of those animals are quite healthy, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Even Newkirk herself has admitted that they kill healthy, adoptable animals. And if you follow the court case that occurred in North Carolina a couple of years ago, ultimately PETA staff were found not guilty of animal cruelty because if you register as a shelter, you can kill even healthy animals. But the uncontroverted evidence that came out of that trial, what I thought was clear and convincing evidence, was that some of these people did give their animals to PETA. Because PETA told them that they were, great animals and that they would find them homes, only to have PETA put those to death. And in one case, which was I thought was tragic, a veterinarian had a mother cat and her young kittens, and he was going to find them homes himself. But PETA said, look, we'll find them a home. And he thought to himself, they have millions of members. It'll be easier for them to adopt these animals than it would for him. These are cats that were in no danger of being killed, and they died within minutes in the back of the van that PETA picked them up with, and then PETA staff threw their bodies into a supermarket dumpster.
Right. I've always really been confused by that. And, they don't just kill healthy animals, but they even go as far as demonizing the no-kill movement. What do you think motivates that?
The buck stops with Ingrid Newkirk. Not only do they demonize the no-kill movement, they have called for the mass killing of all dogs identified as pit bulls, even healthy, friendly ones in shelters. They supported the pit bull breed ban in Ontario. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a community that has pound seizure, meaning, healthy, friendly pit bulls are being taken from families just because someone says they look like a pit bull, and they're being sold to these companies that do vivisection on them, and PETA supported that law. That, to me, is a core violation of the philosophy of animal rights on so many different levels. They oppose, non-lethal solutions for feral cats, any effort to change the status quo is met with a hostility and a recrimination that is so beyond the bounds of reason. In terms of them attacking me, as mm-hmm. I said earlier, I started this movement in animal rights. I once volunteered for PETA before I knew what they were truly about. I was an attorney for a group called Farm Sanctuary that worked on farmed animal issues, mm-hmm. And I'm writing a vegan cookbook. I am an animal rights activist, mm-hmm. and I wear the label proudly, but they lie about me, and they accuse, when people say, like Nathan says this or that, they say, well, he's trying to destroy the animal rights movement. If anybody's destroying the concept of animal rights, it's PETA with its pro-killing diatribe, and its merciless attacks on no-kill advocates. If anything, the no-kill movement is a movement for animal rights, mm-hmm. by arguing that animals have a right to live.
Right. Now, about the pit bulls, I don't think a lot of people know anything about this. And you wrote an article called Stoking the Fires of Hate, How the Animal Protection Movement is Failing Pit Bulls. Can you go into that a little bit about what's happening in the communities where there's a ban on pit bulls?
Well, we have demonized a dog that looks a certain way. If we can take a step back for a second, there was a study done in the United States last year where researchers took all dogs that shelter workers identified as a certain breed and then tested them against DNA evidence for those dogs and found that shelter workers were wrong as much as 87% of the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these dogs that we think are pit bull, in most cases don't have any pit bull in them. But because someone says they look like a pit bull, in these communities with a ban on the breed, not only if they end up in shelters are they killed, even if they're healthy and friendly or treatable, but officers are going door to door and seizing these family members, you know, that have done nothing, that are mm-hmm. loved by their families, on threat of incarceration of the person, and they're putting them to death. And there are some members of this movement that have joined that witch hunt, and they tell themselves that, well, you know, nobody will adopt them because they have such a bad reputation, even those that admit that pit bulls themselves are not inherently dangerous. Will tell themselves this is for their own good, and consequently, you know, the dogs that need the compassion and the advocacy of the humane movement the most don't get it. Mm-hmm. PETA has been at the forefront, and as I said before, even in those shelters that turn around and sell these dogs to, you know, vivisection, PETA has embraced and supported the breed ban in that community that has led to those results. When in reality, since these are the dogs that need our help the most, we should be the most vocal in our mm-hmm. advocacy for them. And that is where a lot of people who claim to have the best interest of dogs at heart have actually turned around and betrayed them the most.
Great. I think we're all out of time now. Thank you so much, Nathan, for
joining us. I learned so much, Nathan. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I look forward to your vegan cookbook, too.
Yes,
me too. Thank you. Thank you. I promise you won't be disappointed.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Nathan Winograd is a pioneer of the no-kill movement and author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution. To find out more about Nathan's work, please visit nathanwinograd.com. That is NathanWinograd.com.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Show on 102.7 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. I just wanted to remind people to join our Facebook group. I put a call out a couple of weeks ago for our listeners or supporters or whoever wanted to join our group, and we had over like 100 people join mm-hmm. in a week. I was very shocked. So let's make it more. Let's get up to 300. Also, you can email us if you have any comments or suggestions about the show. Our email is radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We have Twitter too. Animal Voices YVR is our Twitter. And don't forget, we're looking for guest co-hosts. If that interests you at all, if you want to be a famous radio star and come on our show occasionally to help out here and voice your opinion, please email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. On next week's show, we will be featuring Ethan Smith, who is the author of the book Building an Ark, 101 Solutions to Animal Suffering, which happens to be probably one of the best animal rights reference books I have ever read myself, and I want to have him on the show to ask him all about it.
That would be fun.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So we will have him on the show next week and talk to you next week.
Great. See you next week.